Hello and welcome to episode 14 of A Life in the Landscape, a photography podcast with me, Peter Cox, and my good friend, as always, Roger Overall. How are you?
I actually managed to burn myself this weekend. Now, you being a redhead, on the one hand, have the natural ability and the better ability to make vitamin D than people like me, blondies and brunettes.
Is that so? I thought that we were deficient because we don't produce melanin in our skin. That's why we freckle.
Ah, well, I read recently that you're more effective at making vitamin D because you've got nothing to stop the sunlight getting through. Whereas, you know, the rest of us have a bit more. Now, that said, I burned. You're obviously out and about a lot more than the average desk worker and office worker. How do you protect yourself?
I wear lots and lots of factor 50 and hats because I'm also bald on top. So that does cause problems, yes. So, factor 50 is my friend.
Factor 50 is your friend. You could be the spokesperson for Factor 50.
Max Factor 50.
Max Factor 50. So any pharmaceutical companies listening who make this kind of cosmetic product, Peter is a willing spokesperson. Now, you have been out, though. I don't even know where to start, actually, with my questions for you, because you've just done some quite incredible things. Let's start with the gear side of it. You have bought the biggest piece of photographic gear I have ever seen in my life.
Yes.
You know, I used to lust after a big, long, fat lens, but you've just trumped that.
Well, my new piece of gear has a focal length of 5.85 meters.
And how does it mount onto a camera?
Well, the camera actually mounts onto it. It's like, you know, it's a really long lens. You know, you put the lens on the tripod and then you put the camera on the lens. It's a bit like that with this. Yes. No, it is in fact a boat. I always knew that photography would get me a yacht someday. I'm still waiting for that. But in the meantime, so as you all know, or at least those of you that listen regularly know, I'm working on a book on the islands. And the idea is to photograph them from land, sea, and air. And the seaside can be a bit of a problem. So because I'm going to be doing quite a bit of work offshore, and I have in the past hired a lot of boats, and that can get expensive, I decided it would be cost effective and pretty cool to invest in a RIB, which is a rigid hulled inflatable boat. So it's got a rigid V-shaped hull for cutting through the waves, and then it's got the inflatable sponsons for stability and buoyancy. And that's been in the offing for about nearly 5 months now, and I just took delivery over there a couple of weeks ago.
We all know we can order a camera online. We can order anything online. I mean, how do you go about acquiring a boat, and how did you decide what kind of boat was going to be suitable to help you take photographs of the islands for this project?
Well, I went to Amazon and I looked at the reviews. No, it's not that far away from being able to
downloaded
do that.
A boat from the internet. Yes.
Yeah, I 3D printed it. So I spoke to my good friend Willie Kennedy, who is a guy that operates boat tours around the Skelligs. I've known him for a good number of years now and used his boat quite a bit in my photography. And so he was very good in terms of giving me advice, and also Biddy O'Connor, who runs the Peg Sears and Dingle, that takes people out to the Blasket Islands. And both of them gave me really good advice on what kind of boat I should be looking for. And then Willie, you know, basically put the feelers out and to people that he knew in the industry, asking, you know, if they knew of a good secondhand boat coming available, that they would please get in touch with him, and then he would get in touch with me. And that's pretty much what happened. So Ribcraft, which is a maker of these boats in the UK, got a boat back from somebody that bought one in 2006 and had nearly not been used at all in that time. And the guy decided he was going to sell it. So he sold it back to them, and then they resold it on to me. So it's practically new. And in fact, they did a lovely job cleaning it up, and it looks like a brand new boat.
And I mean, when you got the boat, did you have to modify it in any way? Was it just ready to go straight away? Or talk about that experience, because, I mean, is it like buying a car? Can you customize it? Well, I suppose this one was already in existence, so you couldn't really customize it too much. Or could you?
Yeah, the customization is, I mean, there's a lot of customization you can do if you're buying a new boat. Now, obviously, this is a used boat, so it, all that had already been done. So it's 5.8 meters. So it's, and it has seats for six people, but it can carry 12, you know, you could have another six people sitting on the sponsons, but that's not the use that I'm going to have it for. So I wanted there, it has basically four seats, two single seats in the front, one for the driver, one for a passenger. And then there are two seats behind that are longer. They're jockey seats. So they're the kind of seats that you straddle, your feet are on the ground, and there's a cushion between your legs, basically, that, and you, they are in fact called jockey seats for a very good reason, because in any kind of, when you're going at speed in any kind of waves, you're going to be bouncing a lot, and so you use your legs as shock absorbers. So you're basically gripping the sides of the seat with your knees, bending your knees, and you know, taking the odd impact on your on the cushion. But most of the time, you're essentially standing, you know, gripping on for dear life. And some of the two back seats are longer, so you can have two people that are sort of cozy with each other sitting, you know, front to back on them. And I had wanted, because there's not a lot of deck space, and so because of the, it's there's a console at the front you drive from, and then you've got these four seats, and then the engine, and there's only a small bit of deck space between the back seats and the engine, which is an outboard engine. I had a notion that I wanted to remove those back seats, but they're actually part of the hull. So you'd have to cut them out, refinish the hull, and then reattach them in some way. And that was something I was going to do. But with time and cost considerations, I decided that I would leave it as it was for the moment. The reason to have the larger amount of deck space would be if I wanted to fly the large drone off of it. But I've decided that the small drone is capable enough now that for that side of things, it's plenty good enough without needing to go to the bigger one.
And was it delivered to you? How do you get hold of, I mean, do they FedEx these things to you? I'm just asking the most ludicrous option here. What, do they drop it off at your house and say, there you are, here's your practically 6 meter long boat, good luck? Or do you go to a marina to pick it up? How did you actually get hold of the boat?
I got hold of the boat by, they could have shipped it to me. That's the normal way that would be done, is it would be loaded onto a container basically and shipped by truck. But what I wanted to do, just to do it really, was I drove over to Yeovil, which is, I can't remember which county it's in, but it's basically just south of Cardiff in England, just on the other side of the Severn. From there, so I got the ferry over and drove there, and then hitched up the trailer to the back of the Jeep and then drove it back. So that's about 16 hours of driving round trip.
That's
plus the ferry time.
Plus the ferry time. And are you proficient? Because, you know, if I put a 6 meter practically long boat on the back of a trailer that's going to be even longer than that, I wouldn't be so good with maneuvering. You're experienced, or did you become experienced in the 16 hours that you had?
I had done work with trailers, and actually it's an 8 meter long trailer. From the hitch to the back of the boat is 8 meters. So it is, it's like towing a big caravan behind you. So I have done some small bit of stuff with trailers, but only just kind of borrowing my neighbor's trailer for an afternoon to go and drop stuff at the dump. That kind of thing. So what I did was I went back to my neighbor and I borrowed his trailer and spent an hour or so reversing my car around the house, because we've got this sort of circular driveway around the house, and sort of, and also, you know, the boat is basically parked between the house and the shed, so it takes it needs to be very precisely maneuvered in there. So I practiced doing all that while my dogs went completely apeshit inside, wondering what the hell was going on out there.
So let's just, because, you know, we're photographers, and we love our specs, and we love our we love the gear bits and the numbers that go with that. You mentioned an outboard engine. I would imagine it must be quite powerful. How big an engine do you have?
So it's a 140 horsepower four stroke engine, and so that engine with that boat, its top speed in flat water would be about 42 knots, which is about 47, 48 miles per hour, but you would cruise at about 20. So your most efficient speed is about 20 knots or thereabouts. And at that speed, you're burning, with this configuration, you're burning about 3/4 of a liter of petrol per nautical mile traveled. So you don't have terribly good gas mileage, shall we say. So there's a 180-liter tank, so I can go, you know, about 250 miles or so on a tank.
And so there's no slouch, clearly. I mean, if it can go that speed, it's quite a powerful engine then. And the boat is clearly designed for speed rather than stability. So,
well, no, it's so ribs are inherently very, very stable. They're you know, ribs would be the design of choice for sort of inshore lifeboats and things like that. And so, you know, you can have ribs that are teeny tiny things that are not good in rough conditions. This one is rated like it's a sort of a class B boat in the scheme of things, which means that it can theoretically handle 4-8 winds and 4-meter seas.
Holy cow.
So, but that's way more than I would ever take it out in. So it's nice to have that sort of, you know, extra in the bank. It's like you always want things to be more capable than, you don't want to be using things near their design limits, right?
No, and also I don't think any, I've only ever been out in a 4.7 and that was enough for me.
Yes.
That was plenty. I do not want to experience a force eight. Okay, so you've got this boat. Is it like a car? Do you need a license to be able to drive, for lack of a better word, the boat? Or can anybody pick up a boat of this configuration and just take it out to sea?
You don't need a license, no. I mean, obviously, common sense would dictate that you would go and get some training, but legally speaking, you don't have the same requirement that you do in a car. So, I mean, if you want to do things commercially and carry passengers, then obviously you need certifications for that. But just to get in it yourself and drive away, anybody can do that. So I have, however, you know, with my work in the Arctic and the Antarctic and driving Zodiacs and so forth, so I had, you know, a powerboat level 2 rating, and I've just completed the advanced powerboat course, which I actually did in my own boat after I got it. Yeah, so that's side of it. I mean, it just makes sense. You don't go out in something because it's the kind of boat that can get you into a lot of trouble if you use it wrongly, and it has enough power to cause injury and do all sorts of terrible things if you misjudge it. So you do want to know what you're doing.
And also let's face it, the waters around Ireland, certainly on the West Coast, you know, they're not gentle, kind waters either. And there's lots of rocks and there's lots of gotchas, I would imagine. So I suppose, yeah, you do need to know what you're doing in a boat like that. I'm curious then, so you've got the boat, inevitably, the things that go with boats and come with boats. Can you talk around your experience of, okay, you've got the boat and now you need bits and pieces to go with the boat?
Well, yes. I mean, the Chandlery in Cork, which is the sort of boat supply place. Yes, I'm definitely their new best friend, and they've been very good to me. And you know, you go in there and you with an extensive shopping list, and you go through it, and you get all the stuff, and then you go back and you go out once or twice, and you go, yeah, I really need this, and I need this. So I mean, I've spent probably 3 or 4 times what I plan to on gear. But I suppose the other thing is, because of what I'm doing, most of the time when I'm on the boat, it's going to be me by myself. So I've overspecced a little bit on the safety side of things, just because, you know, I need to have as many options as I can if things happen. So, you know, for example, I've got, you know, the personal locator beacon, and I've got, you know, invested in a sea anchor and, you know, really good chart plotter. And also I'll be putting in an AIS transponder, which allows you, you know, so basically that sends out a location signal. So if I'm out and something happens and I get thrown off the boat, then at least there's a last known position for people to start searching, that kind of thing.
I think that also means you would show up on I think there's a website.
There is a website, yes.
Yes, yeah. And you would show up and we'd say, there's Peter.
Yes.
You know exactly where you are.
Yes, exactly.
So you, now that does mean you're going to be have to be absolutely uber truthful when you go out and not take any risk, because otherwise your wife will be watching and you'll get back and she said, I saw you where you went.
There was a very funny thing. I was looking at the personal locator beacons, which is basically a thing that you have to trigger manually. And, you know, it basically sends out your location to a satellite, which then the emergency services are alerted. And then it sends out a homing beacon on the aircraft distress frequency so you can be found. And part of this is you need to register it. So you basically go to the ComReg website and you put in the serial number of this thing, and you have to give them three contacts. Of people that they can call. So basically, if this thing goes off accidentally, they can call and they can say, what's going on? And you say, oh, actually, no, sorry, this was a false alarm. But also, if it does go off and they ring, they can then get an idea of whether it's likely to be an actual problem. So you have to give us, as I said, three names, and those people, they might not know exactly where you are, but at least they can say, yes, he's out on the boat, or he's often out on the boat and he's out there alone, that kind of thing. And I was just looking at websites because I was trying to get a picture of how it all worked and what the response time was likely to be and all of that, and what their procedures were, like if they can't get an answer, do they still launch a search, that kind of thing. And there was one guy who was sort of asking, you know, how important it was to have these contacts. And he was having problems coming up with somebody to use as a contact. And some guy responded, well, just use your wife. And the guy's response to that was, well, I can't use my wife because I'm often not where I've promised that I'll be. So, and the guy's response, the same guy responded that suggested his wife, said, well, then just add your wife and your mistress.
Oh, dear. Well, surely the boat is the mistress. The boat becomes the mistress. Now, before people start tuning out because they think, hang on, have I wandered into the nautical life with Peter Cox? We need to bring this back to landscape photography. Have you've been out on the boat already, I know, to take photographs. Can you talk about that? What was your experience going out for the first time and taking photographs on your new mobile platform that is so big it is in fact balanced by water?
Yeah, so I was wondering a little bit, you know, I kind of committed to doing this thing with the boat, but before, you know, I had some doubts as to whether or not it would be, the photographs that I would get would be worthwhile. I have done a lot of boat-based photography before, but it's been in the Arctic and it's been of icebergs and things like that, and it's been a little bit different. And you know, with a boat, it's very difficult to do this you know, foreground background stuff where you've got really wide angle and you're really close to your foreground, because surprise surprise, you don't want to get too close to rocks on a boat. So I kind of went out the first time, and I decided to go a place that I knew well, that I've photographed quite a lot, just to sort of ease myself into it. And so I took it out to the Skelligs. Now I didn't, you know, I actually did go out to the Skellig just to put the boat through its paces, but I didn't land and I didn't photograph around there. But I did want to get two particular photographs. I decided that I would photograph Lemon Rock, which is so the Skellig are actually three islands. There's the Great Skellig or Skellig Michael, there's the Small Skellig, and then there's also Lemon Rock, which is between the Small Skellig and the shore. And it looks quite small. Like if you look at any of my aerial photographs of the Skelligs, you'll often see Lemon Rock, and it's this little tiny dot in the distance. And it's a fairly small rock, but when you get close to it, it is actually, it's 20 meters above the sea, and it's probably, I don't know, maybe a quarter of an acre in area or something like that, maybe a bit smaller. And I'd driven past it a lot, but never paid it a lot of heed, but I had noticed that it looked much more dramatic close to than I'd expected. So it was last week when we had some really nice stable weather, not a lot of wind and good clear skies. And so I decided I'd put the boat in the water, do a sunset shoot, do a sunrise shoot, and then recover the boat and head back. So I went out, and the sunset, you know, I went out during the day just kind of practicing with the boat and doing a bit of scouting to see if I could find some angles or locations that would work well. And one of those spots I went to was Lemon Rock, and I found an angle that I thought would work really well for the sunrise. And then I decided that I would go and try to photograph the sun setting between the two Skelligs, because it looked like it was going to set all the way down to the horizon and we'd be able to see the sun right on the horizon, which, as we've spoken about in this podcast before, doesn't often happen. And so I got out the photographer's ephemeris and I figured out, you know, roughly where I needed to be so that the sun would set between the two islands. And it turns out it's off of Bolas Head, which I've been to before many times, but the road only goes out so far. And actually the place I needed to be would be, I would have to be in the water. There was no other way to get to the particular position I needed to be in at this time of year. And so I went out and it was a lovely calm evening. And I arrived about 15 minutes or 20 minutes before I needed to be there. And so I, you know, get to a spot where the sun is between the two islands, stop the boat, get out, just kind of hang around, take a couple of photographs, and then, you know, scarper on because the sun was constantly moving. And I actually got a fairly nice photograph of the sun coming down between the two islands, which we will link to, and it's on the website in the new work section. And it did indeed go all the way down to the horizon. So quite a nice image and really nice to be able to position the sun exactly where I wanted it. And that was all fine.
Were you, just very quickly, were you under pressure then to get back? Because the sun sets and then you have a limited amount of daylight to get back to your, well, where you started from.
So Port Magee was my base for this. I didn't launch the boat there. I launched it in the Glen, which is nearby, which is a floating dock, right? So you don't have to worry about tides. And that's where I was going to be staying that night. And the lovely thing about Ireland is being so far north, twilight lasts for quite a while. So civil twilight ends an hour at this time of year, about an hour after sunset. And then you got nautical twilight, goes another hour or so. So there was plenty of time to get back and it was going to take me half an hour. So basically once the sun went down, because I don't have I can't put the camera on a tripod. It's not going to do a lot of good for long exposures on the boat. So once the sun goes down, there's no more photography to be done from that platform. So I just zip back half an hour to where I was going. And it's actually funny because I was wearing my sunglasses, you know, both because it was a bright day and also, you know, it helps to protect against the wind and the spray. And as I'm driving back, I'm thinking to myself, wow, it's really getting dark really fast. This is a bit boring. Am I going to be able to get back in time? And I was wondering about it for about 2 minutes. And then I realized, oh, you idiot, you're still wearing your sunglasses.
So was the boat moored or was it, so you say you bought a sea anchor. I mean, for this particular photograph, was the sea anchor out or were you close enough to land that you were able to moor somewhere, or was the boat actually off the coast and you're on this platform that is moving? Because what I'm trying to get at is you have your camera. Was it on a tripod? Was it handheld? I mean, how did you get the horizon straight? Gosh, there's a very long-winded way of asking you. How did you get the horizon straight on a moving platform, Peter?
So a sea anchor is actually, a sea anchor is something you use to keep the boat's head into the seas if you lose engine power, particularly in heavy weather. A boat will naturally tend to want to put its stern to the waves, which you don't want. So a sea anchor is an emergency piece of gear, although fishermen do use it for a different purpose. But what I was doing, so it was quite calm, and I've plenty of experience shooting from boats, and essentially you just shoot handheld and you sort of brace yourself and use a fast shutter speed. So I was shooting at, you know, ISO 400 and about a 600th of a second. And then, you know, you just try to keep the horizon reasonably level, but you're always going to be off by a degree or two, except for the occasional just blind squirrel occasionally gets, or the, you know, clock being right twice a day, even when it's stopped. But, you know, you it's surprisingly easy to keep the horizon level or near to, and then just, you know, correct the last couple of degrees that you're off in post-processing later on.
And how are you in terms of, I mean, look, I think we've mentioned this before, I get seasick looking at a cup of tea. how are you that way? Because I can imagine you're concentrating on one thing and yet there's this motion, even if the water's quite calm. And I know you took another photograph and the water looks a lot more swirly and a lot more active. How do you get on with that sort of thing? Or are you just, have you got born and bred sea legs and it does not bother you at all?
No, I get seasick, which is sort of an odd thing to do and then go and buy a boat. So the next morning I went out to Lemon Rock for sunrise and it was a bit more choppy, you know. So I'm fine when the boat's moving. But when the boat's hove to and you are stationary and there's that kind of corkscrewing motion that happens, and that's the thing that sets me off, I can usually be okay if I'm photographing, if I'm looking through the lens, or if I'm flying a drone and I'm looking at the screen. Surprisingly, I'm usually okay. And if I'm having to do something on the boat, or if there's something that really demands my attention that's immediate, that also means I'm okay. But as soon as I'm not requiring that, that's a problem. And particularly like reaching down into bags and or if I'm working with a drone, you know, clipping arms up and fiddling with cameras and anything that requires your head to be down and looking in the boat, that sets me off. So when I got out to the location for sunrise the next morning, the camera was misbehaving, which was annoying. So I'm trying to troubleshoot this camera, which of course requires looking down. And then I'm, you know, looking up to take the occasional photograph and then sort of leaning over the side and retching. and that's just the way that I'm wired. So it's not particularly pleasant.
No, the glamorous life of a landscape photographer, folks.
Yes. So you've got to suffer for your art, right? And I do. When I'm out in a boat, it's an odd mixture of great enjoyment just to be out on the water and zipping around, and just abject misery when I'm leaned over the side and puking. So it's a very odd mixture. But it's transitory, and once you've thrown up, everybody's different. But for me, I feel fine for about an hour afterwards. And again, as soon as the boat gets moving again, I start to feel better almost immediately. So it's a cost of doing business. You know, it's you just, you know, get on with it and then move on and get back to work.
It's an interesting use of an accountancy phrase. Interesting conversation with your accountant as well. I'd like to put down as a cost of doing business.
Vomiting.
And therefore, what can we deduct from the tax bill that's associated with vomiting? So now that the Lemon Rock photograph is again handheld, because the seas there look a lot more active than in the one with the Skellig at sunset, the two other Skellig islands at sunset.
Yes, so handheld again, and again just a high shutter speed and a high ISO to keep everything stable. So I mean, you know, you try to be as stable as you can, but obviously you are moving. And when you're reasonably close to an object, as I was, there's going to be an apparent motion there. So you just have to, it's just like being in an airplane or a helicopter. You've just got to keep the shutter speed up.
And just out of interest, what camera were you using on this shoot? Because photography, podcast, gear, geeks.
I was using the Phase 1. I was using my own Phase 1 rather than the one I have on loan, because I figured if anything was going to go in the drink, it should be it should be my own one. And so it's a bit of an older one, so it doesn't do quite as well at the high ISOs, but it managed fine. It's ISO 400 is fairly safe with it, and the dynamic range that it offers is pretty good even at that level.
And it looks pretty, I mean, you know, just looking at these pictures, the dynamic range looks very, very good indeed. Okay, so what else? Did you learn anything in particular, anything new, or was it just that you sort of, okay, I've photographed in the Arctic, I've done photography from boats before, there's not a lot of massive difference, or is it like chalk and cheese, the two environments?
They're very different in terms of, well, not, I mean, yes, they are. they are different. I was reassured with, you know, both the photographs that I got, and then also the locations that I scouted, because I explored up and down the coast the previous day in that area, and you know, found some little locations and some little alcoves that really would work well in the right light. So it's a bit like flying the drone for the first time, you know, where you had all this low hanging fruit of stuff that had never really been photographed from a serious landscape point of view before, and it just opens the whole thing up to you.
And that's why, in a way, that's good, as you say, reassuring, because the last thing you want is to go through all the expense, all the effort of getting the boat and setting it up and going out, and then actually finding, no, this is just not going to work. I'll have to put it on eBay again, see if Amazon will take it back or whatever. But
yes. I mean, the nice thing about these boats is that they do tend to hold their value. So, you know, I even after 2 years of use, if I keep it in good use and good nick, I should be able to get what I paid for out of it. So it's a I went into it knowing that if the whole thing didn't work, if being sick on the water was too miserable, or if there just weren't the opportunities, I knew I'd be able to turn it around and get my money back on it.
Well, I think we've been talking long enough, quite frankly. Well, one of us has anyway.
The three remaining people are about to drop off to sleep, so yes.
Where can people, well, first of all, I mean, look, where can people follow you? Because I saw an Instagram post of you doing this stuff, so on location. So where can people follow to pick up and see when you are out and about and on those occasions that you do post?
The increasingly infrequent occasions, although as we get going on this project, it'll become more frequent. But certainly Facebook, I'm Peter Cox Photography on there. And then there's also Instagram, which is at Peter Cox Photography also. And those are the best places. And then, of course, you can see the results on petercox.ie. And you can come into the gallery on Plunkett Street. I apologize. Even after a year, Plunkett Street in Killarney.
You don't even know where your own gallery is.
I don't. I don't know where I am most of the time. So,
Because Peter is far too modest, you can buy prints of the photographs that we have been talking about, the Skelligs at Sunset and Lemon Rock. And you can buy those online at petercox.ie, or you can go into the gallery, as Peter says, if you can find it, and buy prints there. Well, I think that pretty much wraps it up for this episode.
Indeed it does. Thanks for listening.